Welcome back to Grit. After a long break, we are looking forward to kicking off season 5 with filmmaker and educator Dr. Neil Fox. In this episode, we talk about the delicate balance between media education and professional practice, an area of interesting research Neil has pioneered in the Sound Image Cinema Lab at Falmouth University, where students and professionals contribute in the production of micro-budget feature films. This was a fascinating discussion on topics close to both our hearts, so enjoy. Right, we're going to jump over to Falmouth in the UK today to talk to Dr. Neil Fox, who is a media educator and filmmaker. Hi, Neil, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's lovely to talk to you.
No, it's lovely to catch up, and it's nice to delve into a part of England that isn't London, that is connected with filmmaking.
It's very not London. And to be honest with you, it's not really England.
No, it's its own sort of netherworld. Yes, yeah.
Indeed.
So I wanted to talk to you today because I feel like everything I've been doing so far is talking to kind of practitioners and talking to various different roles in the field. And it's all around trying to kind of help media students understand these roles and understand people's experience. But I feel that I never really get to the nub of, well, what is media education and how does it work and what's good with it, what's bad with it. So I really wanted to kind of get some of your takes on it because it's an area that you research, but also you're a practitioner. So where do we start? How do you feel about the field of media education at the moment?
What a big question to start with, John. I feel kind of simultaneously positive and, you know, a negative, I think, like most things, and that's probably a bit of ambivalent answer. But I think that media education has fallen into the trap of, which a lot of humanities and arts courses have, which is to kind of scrabble around and try and react to, preempt, and, you know, kind of cater for their industry or their field in as direct way as possible, which is not a great use of resources. It's not a very sensible use of resources, you know, given how quickly media fields change in real time and what is hip and what is current and what technology is being used. And also what a university or a college should or can do. So there's long been an identity crisis, I think, in terms of media studies that, you know, and every couple of years, there's a new thing that says, you know, we're just not very good at communicating what we do, which is odd because it's a communication field.
Yeah.
You know, but it is a recurring problem in terms of, like, how do we, as media educators, communicate to schools, colleges, parents, students, government, and industry what we do and why we're valuable? And I think because of all those partners and collaborators and people that we have to address, it's hard to really nail it down because you're constantly thinking with so many different hats, you know, recruitment, attainment, retention, experience, you know, graduate data, like all these things. It's a different direction, you know, and everyone's got different demands on that you do. So it is a constant challenge. But I think within that, I think that, you know, because it's a creative field, I think there are a lot of really interesting ways of approaching it that do the job well, or redesign what the job can be.
I think one of the big problems I've always found with media education is it has a bit of an identity crisis on a regular basis, in the sense of people look at it and think, oh, it's all about making film and TV people. And then we try and recruit as well and say, well, no, it's about creativity, it's about innovation. And actually, when you look at the wider transferable skills of a media education, there's lots to be had there and lots of interesting applications, but we tend to always market it on, here's some students holding a camera and sitting in an edit suite, and therefore we're very targeted towards the kind of pushing buttons and playing with kit rather than some of the more cerebral stuff, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, we've got a really fancy, you know, we've got really fancy cameras, let's show them and get the students through the door, and then hopefully when they're here, give them the skills that we know will be beneficial regardless of where they end up. But it's such a flashy graphic that, you know, it does so much heavy lifting in terms of that. And that's what they want to see. They want to, you know, because I think as well, what's interesting is if you were to put a list of skills on a slide and say, you know, in the UK, like £9,250 a year to present well and problem solve and research, be like, where's the value for money? And then the next slide, you show them two ARRI cameras with all, you know, they're like, oh, I see value for money there, you know. And that's not how it should be reduced to, but it often is, you know. And it's on both sides, you know, because like you say, we need the numbers in order to do the thing. And it's often smuggling in the other stuff after you've kind of got them through the door, I think.
With students as well, do you find a perception issue, particularly when you first come in? Because I often have a struggle with students saying, well, are you practical or are you theoretical? And I always say, I didn't realize the two were mutually exclusive. Do you have similar challenges with that kind of, I'm a learner by doer?
Massively, yeah, massively. But I like that part of it, you know, I like that part of it because part of what I teach and what I like to teach is kind of revealing how, you know, like you say, that's not really a distinction. And in most of the filmmakers that they love, you know, that's not a distinction in terms of how reflective or critical they might be. You know, and like Christopher Nolan's a great example. You know, students love Nolan. You know, they want to be Nolan. You know, and then you talk to him about his education and how he approaches research and who he works with in the research phase and how he thinks about his career and like how he works on projects. Like, he's a very reflective and thoughtful, critical thinker. And I think a lot of that is in the work as well. And it kind of opens them up to that understanding, you know. You can really see the ones that grasp it start to make those connections between their assignments, you know, where they're doing a presentation on genre and they're making a film at the same time. And they can really start to link how you think about the work in a wider context to the work that you're making. That's one of the most exciting sort of challenges that we get with the students that come in. I think some of the other challenges are around the unwillingness to move towards that way of thinking.
I suppose people think the operation of the tools is what's going to enable it. And obviously without that, you can't get very far. But trying to find the balance, and you do quite an innovative approach of mixing the two in a thoughtful way, because you've won awards for that pedagogy. Do you want to just talk a little bit about the filmmaking as pedagogy approach?
Yeah, so that sort of comes from my research and sort of doctorate background, which is in film education, particularly around university teaching, and realizing that, you know, there is always going to be a limit to what you can do in the classroom and what students can do over the course of 10 weeks on a short film, where, like you say, they're literally learning how to push the buttons and then turning something in, which needs to have a reflective element, all that kind of stuff. So we have really pushed our involvement as a resource in Cornwall to production, you know. So we're making our own stuff with professional filmmakers, using the staff to develop and work on projects which are professional projects, which the students then work on, partnering with as many people in the region who come to shoot here as possible, so that the amount of opportunities that students get to be on professional sets is considerable, particularly, you know, particularly in Cornwall. And then because we push that to the first and second years, particularly in undergrads, more than third years even, because we get the benefit of that in the course, you know, that feeds back in and the student productions get better because they're able to be on set for 3 days, watch an AD work, watch a production manager work, and bring that back in and go, actually, this is how we're going to do this. I've seen it done. It works really well, you know, in a way that if you were to just put it up on the screen about what a call sheet is and why you need, you know, why you need a Dropbox and that kind of thing, like, they just it doesn't register, but when they see it, they kind of bring it back in, and it's worked really well. And that, because I think one of the things I always found looking at placements and stuff was, like, if you give it to the third years, which is great, and obviously the third years are included, but if you think that the first and second years can't do it, so you limit it to the what you think is a level of experience, you don't see that learning, you know, that goes straight into industry or it goes straight into a freelance scramble. Whereas when it comes back in, the students can process it, you know, and we capture that through interviews, which then goes into research. So we can talk to them and say, like, how did you take that process of working on as a DIT assistant into being an editor on your project? And they can talk about it. They can say, yeah, I thought I would have this workflow and it was this one. And because they sit with a professional DIT technician and talk about it and then bring it back in. So that is something that is ongoing at all stages, from development through post-production.
Do you have any kind of models of mentorship from those practitioners, or is it more kind of experience and being around an observation and working on set, or is there a bit of mentoring in there as well?
Yeah, all sorts really, depending on the production. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, often if we're generating a project like a feature film or a short film within the department, then the students work, you know. And then sometimes with a film like Claire Oakley's Makeup, which shot in the region, you know, we had a really good partnership with that, where it was set visits and shadowing, you know. So we would take the cinematography students and they would spend the morning shadowing the DP, who would then have lunch with them and answer their questions and tell them what to look out for. And then they would spend the afternoon, you know, so because obviously that was a much bigger production and didn't need us in the same way. But other things, you know, they'll be holding booms and they'll be doing the logging and the rush, you know, they'll actually be doing the jobs. They won't be watching it. And that's exciting because when your filmmakers come to us, we say, like, if you want to make a film, we can make it work, but you have to work with this renegade bag of students. And they love it, you know, because the students are eager and keen, and there's something about the pressure of actually doing it. And you know that you're not being assessed on it, but you need to get this done that really sort of trains them into making it work. And if they don't make it work, that's where we, you know, we learn and we teach, because we're on set almost as teachers, kind of guiding them and saying, like, if in a different context, this would have been a really bad thing to say or do, or, you know, look out for these things. We can just sort of walk around and do that extra level teaching on the sets on a couple of days, which again is so different to the theory that you might have to do in a classroom.
No, definitely. And I mean, from my own experience, it wasn't until I made my first feature as a line producer with, I know, 20, 25 other recent graduates. That's how we all learn how to do it. And I feel sorry for the actors that had to go through the process, but it's all fine in theory, but until you get that, it's like you couldn't learn to drive a car unless you get in a car and drive it, even though you might have somebody guiding you for through the first bits of it. Yeah,
absolutely.
So how do you work in terms of attracting filmmakers to the region and then partnering with funding? How does that all work? Because that must be quite a complex system of how to attract people into the region and then work with arts councils and so forth.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the benefits of being in Cornwall, really. You know, we don't really have to attract people here. You know, people want to shoot in Cornwall. You know, they want to make films here. There's something about, and what's interesting is the kind of filmmakers that we work with at that kind of independent micro-budget level are interested in Cornwall as a place. You know, like they're not coming here to shoot a Second Home ad, to be political. You know, they're interested in using landscape and place. And also, Cornwall's very little seen. You know, like there's Poldark and there's Doc Martin, which are kind of give a particular picture of Cornwall. But I think that, you know, there is an interest in what else is there and what other landscapes are there to work with and what other kind of places and stories can be told. So, you know, it's quite an attractive place for filmmakers to come. And when they reach out, there's not many people down here. There's us and Screen Cornwall, who we work very closely with. But that's it, really. Where else would you go in a place like this? We're the only university, the only film course, you know. So it's a limited pool for them. And also, you know, Mark Jenkins Bate and Mark as a filmmaker did a massive, you know, shone a massive light on us as a place, but also as a project.
Yes, great. And you yourself made a film in this same way. Is it, you were the writer producer, is that correct?
So Wilderness is, yeah, it was, we made it in 2016. It was released last year by Sparky Pictures. That was the kind of the test case, really. So, you know, after I sort of finished my doctorate, you know, my boss said, while I was finishing, he still said, what should we be doing? And I said, we should be making feature films. You know, we should be generating our own feature films, funding them and crewing them with students, you know, micro budget work within the department. Because I wanted to make a feature film. So I was like, you know, see if that works. And he said, yes, let's do that. And I was like, great. So then I wrote it because we didn't have a project that would have fitted those parameters of very little money and a very quick turnaround. So it was written for that, with that in mind. And then, yeah, we shot it in 2016 with four professional sort of heads of department, and the rest of the crew were students who'd never been on a film set before and professional actors. And then it sort of did festivals in 2017. And that was great because obviously there was no pressure on it in a way that, you know, like, because it was a teaching project, and it was a kind of almost a research and development project. It's like, can this be done? You know, can we make films in this way that are viable enough to be out in the world? And we, by out in the world, we thought film festivals. You know, we didn't necessarily think distribution, certainly not at the level that we were funding it and the turnaround we were making it. But so that was a really nice bonus that, again, through that industry network that we've got, people saw it and were like, I think you could probably get this out. And that's kind of what happened. So the test case was sort of proved at every point. Like, can we make something? Yes. Can we make something good? Yes. You know, subjectively, and then that showed us and everyone else, oh, actually what they're doing down there is really interesting and viable, you know. And then obviously when Bait hit, it was, we were able to sort of say, look, we've made all these shorts, we've been involved in all these features, you know, Mark's not working in isolation, as great as he is, you know, and he is brilliant. It's part of an ecosystem that's really developing in terms of this as a means of teaching filmmaking, you know, and also graduate development as well, because a lot of the paid places and the crewing of those projects are graduates that we're reaching out to bring back to help them sort of advance quicker.
Nice. And I think that's such a key, that we need those ecosystems of filmmaking, whereas it's been so transitory and fractured over the last 10 to 15 years. But it seems to be now you are getting these pockets, partly because there's just so much drama production being done now. But you can actually start to have a more sustainable ecosystem. And is that kind of what's starting to happen in Cornwall, just that building up of a system?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of graduates staying on and being able to work on sort of two or three professional short or feature projects a year, you know, which in Cornwall is kind of mad. And it just gives them the impetus to take a bit of a risk. You know, it's as much of a risk as, you know, trying to work in trying to live in London or live outside London and commute to studios. Like it's that kind of risk, but you know, they like the life down here and they want to invest in it, you know, and they can move quite quickly from, you know, production assistant to, you know, first AD down here very, very quickly, because there's not many people doing it. But then also because we're able to place those kinds of graduates in things like the Game of Thrones prequel that shot down here, you know, it's so much cheaper. And then so we get one good graduate on there, and then the, you know, the production coordinator says, can you get other people? And it's like, yeah, well, I'll just reach out to the university. So we ended up having 15 students working on that, you know, because of where we are, and because like it's so much cheaper to just draw them from the local pool than it is to bring them down from London and put them up and or wherever. Even Bristol, you know, like people think, oh, Cornwall is part of the Southwest, but we're 3 hours from Bristol and it's a whole different world, you know. So it really is sort of self-contained and becoming more self-sufficient, which I think is exciting for a lot of productions who want to work down here.
And particularly in a COVID, post-COVID world, being able to have these bubbles that are self-sustained rather than shipping in and out must be a huge advantage.
Yeah, and Cornwall's just a spread out county physically, you know. It's less populated at most times of the year, and easier to maintain that kind of management of that kind of, yeah, that kind of bubble of production that you want to maintain. It is easier here, although it's harder in some ways to get around, particularly with the roads.
With students, how is the kind of spectrum now for talent development in terms of leaving university and going into industry and the ecosystem of development? Because certainly when I entered the industry, it was very fractured and it was all on a very privileged network. And I just wonder if that's improved, and does media education help that or have a part to play in that?
Loaded question, isn't it? You know, I think that...
Yeah.
I think it can, and that's when I was sort of saying at the start about some of the things it's kind of doing well. I think some of the industry partnerships that institutions have and can make really do make a difference. You know, I think that, you know, we've got a number of relationships with production companies and post houses and things like that that have been developed over a long time, where they like our graduates. You know, like we've because of like the way we approach the course and the kind of graduates that we can sort of work up upon leaving, you know, they know what they're getting, and they trust that, you know, they trust that there's going to be a certain level of competence as a person that they can bring in, you know, and it's not about training them on a particular software or whatever. It's about helping them understand a culture, helping them understand process, helping them understand relationships. And then they go in and they learn on the job the specifics of that place. And that's been really good, you know, that we've been able to do that from where we are, you know, and at a remove from the industry physically, but still attract partners who are interested in what we're doing. I think the problem is that the university that in Falmouth is a, you know, it's an arts-based institution, has a particular demographic. It's got a reputation amongst particular parts of the creative industries.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily, and there's something I'm really keen to address longer term, it's not necessarily attracting students that are of a different demographic to what's already there in terms of what makes up the majority of the industry. You know, like there is a job to be done in terms of local Cornish working class. You know, that's a big piece of work here in terms of class, you know, gender, race, because we're so far away from places and people, you know, for a lot of types of students that are thinking of going to university, they would never think that Falmouth would be an option. And even if they do, it's financially, it's a big ask to live here. It's quite expensive. You can't get about very easily. There's a lot of factors that determine the type of student we get, which is probably the kind of students that would be okay anyway in some regard, you know, in terms of the connections they might already have with their sort of family networks. So, you know, it's a bit of both, you know, and that desire from industry is there, but it's hard to do it when you can't get the students that would make an actual change in terms of those opportunities, if that makes any sense.
No, for sure, because I mean, I think that the university I went to was on the outskirts of London, and it was at a time before fees, and as a working class kid, I got to go there, you know, because it was a publicly funded thing. Now you've got fees, it's in central London, and when I go there, I only see kind of a certain demographic of person. It tends to be fairly rich people. Occasionally it draws in from local parts of London, but it really doesn't have the diversity that was there when I was there, which is ridiculous that it's less diverse 20 odd years later.
You know? Where did you go?
Ravensbourne.
Ravensbourne.
I feel that there was an explosion in the 90s of kind of media courses, and there was a proliferation of it. And in some senses, I think there was such a proliferation that it damaged the reputation of media for. I don't know whether you found this, but so often I find that people go, oh, media's like an easy subject to do.
Mickey Mouse subject. It was named as one of the Mickey Mouse subjects.
And I think having also worked with law schools, cognitively, I don't think media is any more simple than doing a law degree or any of those more hard subjects that people would discuss. I just wondered, what are the perceptions you have with parents and students in that respect when coming into media education?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it, in terms of the parents are all worried, you know, so because they're like, that is still a perception. Like, if my son or daughter studies film, what can they possibly do with that? You know, like they just sit around watching films all day, and it's like, you know, I wish, do you know what I mean? I wish that was what I did all day. But there is that perception of like, you know, they're just going to sit around and watch films, and they, you know, like, so then you talk to them about both what the degree is, you know, in terms of like what we're asking them to do in terms of the assessments, but also what filmmaking is, you know, like that, you know, the amount of skills you have to be able to call upon to be a successful filmmaker in any department, really, and how, like you say, how that machinery works, and how you have to understand hierarchies, and how you have to understand departments, you know, like all these things that are really, really important to a successful piece of work. And you can sort of see the parents go, oh, okay, yeah, you know, because, and to be fair, why would they have thought any different?
Yeah.
People watch TV and film for entertainment and escapism, you know, and most people will watch it and not consider as they're watching it how that thing was put together. They'll love Game of Thrones and they'll love No Time to Die, and they'll be like, that was great fun, but they won't break down the you know, and to be fair, there's not like a science program that does it. There's no Brian Cox for film and media that says actually this is, well, Mark Kermode does some of that, you know, and some of his history of stuff is pretty accessible, but people just don't really think about it that way. And what's interesting is that's a lot of the students we get are the ones who have that kind of, they've had that epiphany like most of us have, where we've watched something and gone, well, how the hell do they do that? Or, you know, why do I feel like that? It's a common one as well. Like, I watched this thing and I didn't really understand how I felt, and I wanted to work out how to do that to other people, you know. So I think that there's a real curiosity about the mechanics and the practicalities of making art, which is skills-based and craft-based. And that's what we're working with, which is, you know, we're approaching it in a way where we know that we can't give everyone a job, even if they wanted one. Not everyone should be working in the industry. And we're trying to get people to make their own work, but also understand actually, like, you can do something else, you know? You know, there are other things of value, and not telling them that, but kind of helping them see it for themselves.
Yeah, because it's something that I often think we don't talk enough about in standard media education, is it's not just about film and TV. There are so many ancillary areas that require the skill set. And I think that's screen-based media, for want of a better word, is permeating almost every aspect of life now. So that there might be, you're working in an insurance company and you're doing a whole bunch of stuff. You're not making films per se, but there are other things that you'll be doing that utilize some of these skills.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great story about a student who was a little bit older, you know, sort of came in when he was about 24, 25. He'd done an electrical apprenticeship, you know, and was an qualified electrician, and just kind of, and was like, oh, I want to go and work in film, you know, and wanted to be a director. Came into the degree wanting to be a director. In the second year, sort of did a bit of editing and thought, oh, maybe I want to be an editor. And so he came on to Wilderness as an assistant editor. And there was two assistant editors sort of in with the professional editor every day. And they were just in the camper van, just logging and talking, you know. And he just got a bit restless, and so he kept wandering out. And then he started getting involved in the practical stuff that needed doing, you know, was fixing things and doing bits and pieces, and actually did a little bit of electrical work on the thing. And he sort of said, like, I can do this, and I like this, and I can work in film. And it's like, yeah, people are crying out for electricians.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. He took the skill he already had a great time at university, and then went back in, and now he works sort of in the studio in Cardiff as an electrician. Works on all these films, has a great time, no pressure, and he just loves it. And that's so important. If they don't get a job in a studio, it's hard to track that, because the metrics and the data you have to say is like, this student studied this module and they got this job and they have to be connected.
Right.
And you're like, that's so narrow that it really kind of pushes against what a degree is and should be, in my opinion anyway.
And do you find also, like, talking about that, like you said earlier on, students come in and go, I want to be a director, I want to be an editor. I continually find, like, when I start opening the doors saying, well, there are all these other jobs, do you find the same? It's just like everybody knows the key jobs because of the credits or whatever, but then there's all these other areas.
Yeah, you know, I think when we interview, you can sort of, I'm interested in the students who are like, I don't really know what I want to be. You know, like, I'm interested in film. I've done a bit of all these things you know, I think that's why college courses are really important. I taught a BTEC before I taught at university, which is a kind of like vocational, like A-level sixth form age, but different qualification.
Yeah.
And they just do a bit of everything. You know, those students are coming like, yeah, I'm really interested. I've done a bit of editing. I've done a bit of photography. I've done a bit of, you know, I've made a music video and I've made a documentary and I've done some stills photography. And I just want to do more. Like, I always think that you're going to do much better than someone who wants to be a cinematographer, because you might do that twice in 3 years because of the way the course is designed. Like, there are other courses that are better if you want to do that than us, you know. And some of those students do struggle because they're like, they want the reputation of Falmouth, but they don't want to do the course that we've got, because they, you know, so that's a tension that's quite hard on both sides, I think, you know, because it's like, you shouldn't really be here because this is not what we do. And we do that thing of kind of like, well, try this, try that, move around. And then if you find something sort of halfway through, you can really sort of drill down on it. So you can spend your whole third year just immersed in this thing that you've fallen in love with. And that's kind of exciting. And to see those students kind of unexpectedly end up in experimental or unexpectedly end up in sound and just absolutely tear it apart, you know, it's like so, so fulfilling. And they get so much out of it. And I think when I was younger, I had, and when I started teaching, you know, I kind of probably had, I definitely had a bit of an elitist kind of snobbery in terms of like, why do they only focus on directors? You know, why is it always the same filmmakers? You know, and then I tried to remember what it was like when I went, you know, and I didn't really, you know, like you said, I grew up in Luton, had very little access to cinema. I liked Scorsese and the Coen brothers. And then that's what I went to university for, you know, so it's like kind of, I'm not surprised that they don't know that, you know, who wrote it or who did the score or, you know, who the costume designer was. But that's my job. My job is to introduce them to all that stuff and hopefully get them excited about it and allow them to see that it is, you know, this thing they didn't even know they could do is something they can do. In the same way, that's what it was for me. You know, when I went to university, the thrill was, wow, look at all these things. Like, I'd never even thought this films could be like this, you know, and then it just changes. It just widens your horizons, and it should, you know. And I think that's something it's really important to protect, is that supporting young people usually to enter into the world, you know, and we use the lens of film to do that because that's our course. But it's really about engaging them in other ideas, other perspectives, other people, you know, other countries, other, you know, just other ideas that then they start to see the world in a bigger and more complex way that is hopefully exciting and makes them better people when they leave.
Mm. No, definitely. And I think one of the struggles that seems to happen at the moment, and it's certainly an area that I'm starting to kind of research and look at, is there's one, motivational dynamics as you go through a university course, and then there's the second thing of kind of learning outcomes and assessment, and how do you kind of guide somebody through a course, but you have all of these weird little hurdles that come with higher education and stuff. I'm just wondering kind of what your perspectives are on how do you assess some of these skills and attitudes and so forth, and also just the mechanisms you have to go through in order to get a bachelor.
Oh, John, it's like you've been reading my journals. I'm involved in a series of dialogues with Trinity College London and sort of partners and sort of colleagues here about this very thing, like creativity and education. What is it? How do we assess it? Should we assess it? You know, like that comes up all the time. Like, why are we asking for, why do we have learning outcomes, and why do we break it down into component parts, even though, like, you know, we don't necessarily grade that way, but we're saying you need to cover these three things, and what is the point of that? And I think that as a practitioner, you know, I'm often teaching things that I would not do, you know. I'm trying to introduce students to ways of thinking about screenwriting, and then, like, I had a student today, like, well, what do you do? I'm like, well, I don't do what I just told you. You know, but I've learned over 25 years of doing it that's what I want to do. And I started it the same way that everyone started and worked through that. Like, what are the ways of doing it? Like, what are the, and then being reflective and critical about it. And often that is the conversation. Like, you might find, actually, this is the way I work, and I'm slower. Like, I love this idea, but I write really slowly. And there's me going, deadline 3 weeks time. And of course, the problem that creeps in there is around grades and about their idea of what they need. And if I tell them, just do what you can, grade doesn't really matter. The fact that you've now learned how you write is the valuable part. You can carry that forward. No one cares if you get a 55 or a 65. But the conditioning they've had in their education in the UK to that point, and the pressure they've put on this whole experience to get a grade, to get a job, even though the grade doesn't get them the job, you can see they really wrestle with it. And it's difficult because you're trying to undo all of that conditioning to say, actually, all the things you've been told that matter don't matter. Like, you know, the industry doesn't care whether you got a 2.2 or a 2.1, you know, like, they just don't. It's not a thing, but you think it is. And I can see on your face that you have that so ingrained that when I say, you've already learned what matters. They just don't, they go, no, I need to finish this. I need to get a good grade. And it's like, well, sometimes you're not, because you as a person do it this way and it can't be done in this time now, you know, and that's a reality that is difficult. But the hope is that you can squeak through, and then when they're out of that constraint of university, they start to see it. And part of that as well is bringing in as many people from industry as possible. Like, we do 2 masterclasses a week with industry professionals of various levels and all different departments, so that we can hammer home those things. You know, and we ask the same question, like, what do you look for? Do you care about grades? And they're like, no. You know, are you reliable? Are you polite? Are you hardworking? You know, can you learn quickly? Are you gonna have a meltdown if things are going behind schedule? You know, like, if you can do those things, then come on board, you know. But there's something about that which is really hard to break down, and think that those questions about what we assess and how we assess are really important. And I think over the next few years, I think you will start to see some radical changes as industry and courses align more closely, and it becomes much more holistic about, you know, what you're asking students to do in a classroom. But the problem is that, you know, which is I flagged up last week, is unless that gets communicated back, and that support from the university and industry backwards into colleges and schools is there, the problem will just be as bad as it is now, because it's such a stark change.
No, and we don't have quite the same problem in Norway, because education, higher education, is essentially available to all. It doesn't mean that certain courses you can't get into with certain grades, but it's less of a barrier to entry than it is in the UK, and it's free, which is another bonus as well. But it is still interesting, throughout the schooling system, they've been told you've got to have good grades to get to the next level, and then they get drilled essentially A-level stage, you've got to be able to do this, otherwise you'll never survive at university. And then they come to university and they go, but I've been told that this was kind of like the end of level boss in a game. And it really throws them when it's not.
Yeah.
And trying to explain to them, like, the journey is more important than the destination.
Yeah.
It is. It's really hard, because you've had all of this pressure. And I do wonder, as, like, higher education educators, what do we need to do to permeate back into the schools? Because I certainly don't talk to schools enough about what the expectations of higher education, and maybe need to get rid of, like, go out there and change it in the place, rather than when they get there.
Yeah, I mean, in the ideal world, that's what it is, isn't it? It's outreach, and it's working very closely with, but the problem is that the in the UK, the people in a university that work closely with schools and colleges are recruitment. You know, that's the recruitment arm of the school that goes out and sells the courses, but it doesn't understand the courses, and it doesn't understand the industries. You know, that's not its job per se. Its job is to go out and build links where the schools will feed into, you know. And I would love to get out in and visit schools and talk to students and just, you know, talk to them about filmmaking. And then just start with that. You know, let's talk about filmmaking. What is it? Who does it? How is it done? How can you do it? Like, now. And then this is how you can study it. But my workload doesn't allow for that. No. You know, like, and those kind of problems get in the way of those changes, which are really necessary. You know, we've tried to do it here where, and this was sort of thwarted by the pandemic, where they were starting to send out academic staff with recruitment staff, you know, where we essentially put like a Willie Russell bus tour around the country. You know, where you just get off and, you know, you go in and you talk about your course, and then the recruitment team would do the logistics, you know, the accommodation application and that kind of stuff. And that seems to me like a model that works. But again, it only works if you've got a strategy within your university, and ideally within the sector, which says actually working with schools in this way to really help students and schools understand the culture of university is important. And again, bringing industry into schools to do the same,
yeah,
and making the industry much more accessible to high schools and colleges, and not making it a scramble where everyone's fighting for a bit of the pie in terms of industry partnerships. It should be much more standard that you welcome school visits and you take time out of your day to talk to high schools and you talk to colleges and you say, look, this is all we're doing here is a job.
Yeah.
Like, we've got a job to do. We're all working together to do it. And you're demystifying and you're making it more accessible. But as we've seen from the return to production post-pandemic, no lessons were learned. And it's worse than ever in terms of this idea of pressure and stress and how we need, you know, like the amount of production that's now going on with people burnt out and unskilled. And just, it's just, you're just like, wow, how can it be worse? You know, and that's worrying because it shows again that those opportunities to really address systemic problems across the board, industry and education, there was a golden opportunity there that's not been taken because it's about numbers and bottom line.
Well, that's one of my big concerns with media education is the sort of buzzword, particularly in Norway, and I think it's true elsewhere, is sustainability. And everybody thinks that's recycling and so forth. And I want to kind of ask that question, well, how are we building sustainable media businesses that are healthy, but also then how do we build sustainable media education that feeds that and isn't having to kind of jump on every whim that industry says, start teaching them these buttons. How do we have a sustainable industry and education that works together?
Yeah, I don't know really. You know, like I struggle with that. You know, I struggle with almost the ethics and the morality of a lot of that stuff in terms of what students want when they come in terms of like employability and career development. When I know that I don't want them to work in the industry as it is, you know, like,
yeah,
see so many graduates go into that unsustainable space and absolutely ruined within 6 months. You know, they might do 4 jobs and just be absolutely obliterated by it. And you're like, that's no way to that's no way to run an industry, you know. And if I can see that and I know it's wrong, how do I then tell my students what they have to do to survive in that environment? I find that morally objectionable that's what I'm expected to teach. Like, you know, that level of resilience and exploitation and sacrifice to be a production assistant on a Channel 5, no disrespect to Channel 5, I'm sure they've got great work in Brexit, but you know what I mean? Like, is that the end goal? Like, but what can I do in terms of that sustainability other than try and get them to think about what they make in a different way, you know, to think about getting them to make stuff independently and running their crews differently and then hopefully making work that invites a level of success where the industry is interested in saying, okay, here's feature development, go make a feature. And then when they get there, say, well, this is how we're going to run our, you know, like try and make them so interested in change and making work that they'll be the ones that do it, because I just don't see industry coming towards it and changing its practices in any real way.
No, other than lip service, because I think students often ask me like, oh well, you must have worked in the industry during the worst of kind of Me Too and all of the and bullying and toxic cultures, and I was like, I was lucky not to work in a very, very toxic culture, but I certainly worked on some toxic sets and I had the misfortune of meeting Weinstein once and he was a very toxic person in a bullish kind of Tony Soprano way. But nobody talked to everybody, just said like, oh, you've got to work like this and you should put up and shut up. And I don't want to pass that on to students. I quite regularly will still mentor students who are just in the early stages of their career. And they'll say to me, oh, this person's asking me to work for like £5 an hour for 20 hours a day. And I'm like, sometimes you have to say no and walk away.
Yeah.
Because it's not worth it. But what was fascinating to me was when I had the chance to run a production company with our mutual friend, Dave, I can remember saying like, what if we do it differently? What if we make the working days fine, make employment practices fine? And I think Dave was the first guy I ever employed who I was able to say, here, have paternity leave. I know they say you can't have it, but have it, yeah, because I think it's better as a human being that you're happy. And it was easy to kind of show senior management and that, like, actually, if you treat people decently and we were on really tight budgets, you could still manage it. And that was the thing that kind of blew my mind at that point, was like everything I had been told about, oh, well, it's tight budgets, it was all bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not about, oh, tight money. It's just somebody's taking too big a bit of the pie. That's the harsh reality.
Yeah. And like, so someone's taking too big and has been greedy and said, we can do this by a time.
Yeah.
That can't be done other than in that particular way, and then like you say, then fed it down the chain for people I think that, you know, that's what I like about the job is introducing those ways of thinking and saying, like, when students say, oh, you know, like this, that, and it's like, well, why do you think it's that? Well, because I've seen it. It's like, yeah, but it can be done another way, you know. And you bring in examples of films and filmmakers, or, you know, shows that have done that, you know, and you bring in things like Raising Films and the work they've done, you know, and you say, like, look, you know, things are changing, be on the right side of it, you know, and acknowledge that you might be in a position where, like you say, you're in that conversation, like, actually, no, let's rethink how we do this. Because ultimately, if you're talented and you make good work, then the industry is going to want to work with you. So use that leverage. And that's what I hope we start to see, which I don't think we would have seen post Me Too yet. I think that there's a generation coming through that can make that change in a way that the people who've been working in it for, you know, and I don't think that's necessarily, that's not a blame thing, because I think it's, if you're so conditioned to working in a certain way, same with our students, it's really hard to change direction and change cultures. And, you know, like, I don't think it should have happened overnight that suddenly all these working practices change, because how could they, you know, like, they're so ingrained, almost automatic. So let's see where we can make the change and how we can make the change and be a bit more sort of rational about it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was something, talking to Nicole Cassell.
That was a great interview. I love that.
In my head, I had this sort of slightly gendered idea that more female directors was bringing about a change, but she made a really brilliant point of, like, it's just, actually, it's about diversity of approach. It's not that she's a woman, it's just the fact she's not a shouty Michael Bay character. And there's been two, I think the industry has said, that's what we reward and that's what we need. And it's so nice to now start hearing voices that talk about, like, how to be empathetic to crew, how to look after actors, how to build the right environment, because it should be a safe and creative environment.
Yeah, and I think it's hard, you know, like, it's really hard. Like, it's not, changing the culture is not going to make it easier to make films or make TV shows. Like, it is a really intense process, but I think you can acknowledge that without sort of ruining people and acknowledging that. And I think that's where a university can really do some work, because the way we do things is much more based in independent film. You know, we can't replicate studio practices, you know, in terms of what the students understand to be filmmaking, like Star Wars or a Marvel or a Bond, you know, like, we can't do that. No. We shouldn't do that, but we can do independent film, and we teach that. And a lot of the ways that independent film has worked has long been a reaction against that stuff. You know, filmmakers who actually don't want to work in that way, in that system, and have cultivated other working practices that are now becoming much more, you know, seen as reasonable, you know, like you say, kind of just taking care of people on set and shorter days, you know, leave and having a kind of smaller, more intimate crew who's just much more flexible to each other's needs. And that's the way independent film has long done it, and that's what we can replicate. So students can make those linkages, if they come towards it, in a really meaningful way, because they're like, oh, actually, I can make a film like Kelly Reichardt makes a film, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, you actually can. We can actually do that, you know, in a much more real way than we can anything else.
No, definitely. And I think you know, as they say, you can't boil the ocean, but you can plant the seeds and hope that you can gradually change the industry. I do see kind of little flourishes changing, but it's still kind of a bit of a push of the boulder up the mountain sometimes, I think.
But that's the fun, isn't it? You know, like that's one of the thrills and challenges of teaching is grappling with that stuff and that kind of positive disruption in terms of the classroom. You know, that's what I enjoy certainly is engaging students in those questions and trying to make them see like I say the complexity, but without being like, don't go and work on this, don't do that. You know, like it's hard because you don't want to be a dream ruiner. But you also want them to be able to spot problems and cultural problems as well as technical and kind of process problems.
No, for sure. I mean, I can remember being taught this thing called positive deviance, which is sort of like the ability to look at a system or a situation as an outsider and then make positive change, but slightly by rebellious acts sometimes. And I try and kind of constantly encourage my students to do that, just to say like little random acts of rebellion but in a positive change sort of perspective, like do it through filmmaking, don't just churn out an ad for Nike or whatever, try and sneak stuff in there as well, try and play with it a bit more.
Yeah, a friend of mine used to call it said it was cultural sabotage.
Yes,
which I like that as a phrase. I'll happily be a cultural saboteur.
I'm conscious that we're sort of coming close to the hour. One of the last things I wanted to pick your brains about is obviously you also specialise in podcasting and also film podcasts. And I'm just, I have never approached podcasting other than grab people and have a chat and see where it goes. But I'm interested in kind of like your study of podcasts and particularly using podcasting as a way of disseminating information, knowledge about films, etc. What's your sort of perspective on that?
Well, it kind of goes in, it's in line with that kind of positive deviance, I think. Why is there such a kind of sacred aura around the written as being the kind of the foremost representation of knowledge? Why does an academic journal, the pinnacle of a written academic journal, the pinnacle of research in terms of how it's presented to five people who might pay £80 to see if their university doesn't subscribe? So those kinds of things of like, well, actually, like I don't think that talking about something and working it through in real time and, you know, sort of having a dialogue or a conversation is any less rigorous or academic than one person writing a peer-reviewed paper. And I love peer-reviewed papers and I write them, you know, and I value them, but it's like everything really. I guess it comes back to the film, like why is that the only way, why can you not use different skills, create a different aesthetic, almost create a different form where you can do the same thing in a basic sense of this is what I've been thinking about and this is what the research that I've done and here it is in a form which does that thing which universities and HE says it wants to do all the time, which is reach out beyond its walls. Podcasts are a great way to do that. You know, people listen to them. And also they are a space where people do active listening and they do engage with topics and ways of listening that are not mere entertainment. And I don't mean that kind of negatively. Obviously, that's a very important thing. But they will listen to radio or kind of like Radio Lab or, you know, NPR stuff, you know, really kind of thoughtful, in-depth, reflective, critical pieces of work. And that's brilliant. And I think academic work can be put in that space in a really effective way. And I think with films, what, you know, and my colleague Dario, who I do the podcast with, has written about this in terms of what he calls the audio cinematic. Like, there's a really interesting opportunity to make an audio program about an audiovisual medium where the lack of an image is a challenge and something that's interesting. How do you talk about something that people can't see? And I think it speaks to a pre-internet, pre-digital time, you know, when most people read stuff about films that they couldn't see or they couldn't see for a month or a year. Like it puts people back into their headspace in terms of imagining or trying to remember without having access to those images. And that's a fascinating opportunity. And also, yeah, just they can be very pleasurable in terms of how you construct ideas and portray them through sound, which is not just through speaking, but through the construction of audio content.
And I think the fact that it's such a low barrier to entry as well, it can be a good and a bad thing, but it's, I keep making a joke about if there's a man in the woods without a microphone, does he have a podcast? Or something. There are so many people having podcasts, but the fact that people can do it and disseminate ideas and have these very niche discussions about stuff that formatted shows and formatted radio and formatted TV just doesn't allow that feeling of being down the pub talking to somebody about something.
No, I think that, you know, I think there's definitely been a return to intimate, good faith conversation in podcasting, you know, in a way that, you know, people talk, you know, people sort of say, like, in the 70s and 80s on British TV, you'd have this art show where people sat around and talked about art for an hour and they disagreed, but it was a good discussion. It's like, yeah, that's a podcast. That happens all the time on podcasting. And I think even though we're seeing a real push from big media corporations and platforms in terms of trying to dominate that space, it's still a new medium and it's still got a huge number of people who are interested in finding and want something which they feel is particular to podcasting, which is not regurgitated radio or a kind of sycophantic chat show with celebrities patting each other on the back and then doing each other's shows. Like, the great thing is that you can do your niche, and there's a willingness on the part of listeners to seek that out and to share that and to be part of it, which I think is really exciting. And it feels, you know, it feels like it's in a really nice moment of saying, doesn't matter what Spotify are doing, we can also do this. And people genuinely want that and seek out those different types of content, different types of show.
No, definitely. And I think just being able to very simply record something and stick it out there fairly quickly. You don't need to have a huge marketing budget. Obviously, you'll only get a certain kind of audience and the way aggregation works and the way Spotify curates stuff. But the simple fact is you can connect with an audience that's right for it. And there was a great show, I think, on IFC, and maybe it was on Channel 5 years ago, called Dinner for Five. And it was this wonderful show that just had like five people in an LA restaurant talking about film and their experiences on film, and it was very discursive and so forth. And there was a huge period of TV where that just got lost, and I feel that's now coming back in the podcast where it doesn't all feel sound bites and formatted.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's interesting, isn't it, because I think that there was always that idea around film, like digital in film, that it was democratizing, you know. And it was, like, anyone could go out and shoot a film. But the control, the space of actually seeing that stuff was still controlled by a very narrow, you know, sort of sector of, whereas podcasting is different. Like you say, you know, you can put it up on Anchor and you can put it up on iTunes and people can find it, you know. And if you, again, like, if you've got a hook, people will say, listen to this podcast, I really like it. And word of mouth is, it relies on word of mouth in a really, really important way. Yeah, because I think people are hungry for that stuff that they can't get anywhere else, you know, like that. Where is that stuff on TV? At least on a TV that, particularly with the, if you look at the way streaming services now, everyone's siloed out, you know, it's very expensive to have more than one streaming platform per month. So even if there is a show, or like, if you don't have it, whereas podcasts are still free if you have to put up with some adverts, you know, which is great. And that's how it should be, you know, like, I think, they should be accessible.
And I think it's something where YouTube did do a bit of it for a while, but YouTube seems to have taken, it's almost gone down the youth TV approach of how to engage audiences. It seems very, very,
well, there is a good Flat Earth podcast that
monoculture. Yeah. Cool. Neil, it's been so wonderful talking to you. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm hoping, because our universities are connected, that we're going to get to travel in either direction and hang out in person. It'd been really nice. It's been, and you've got my thoughts going more on pedagogical challenges, and it'll be great to talk to you in the future about that as well.
Great. Yeah, no, I really look forward to that exchange. And yeah, thanks for asking me on. I hope it's been interesting for people. I really enjoyed talking about this stuff. And that's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bet on myself and I proved it. I know the industry ruthless. I'm really a threat, a nuisance. The Chevy you're driving is ruthless. Think I'm the one and I proved it. I know the industry foolish. Think we're seeing the movies. It really ain't driving, I'm cooling.